Уважаемые гости, уважаемые господин...
Distinguished guests, Excellency Mr. Min Aung Hlaing, Excellency Mr. Pashinyan, Excellency Mr. Oyun Erdener, Excellency Mr. Li Jianshu, ladies, gentlemen, I welcome all the participants and guests of the Eastern Economic Forum. Russia, and Vladivostok in particular, is once again hosting the leading business people, experts, politicians, public figures, and officials from dozens of countries from across the world. We also have video addresses from India's Prime Minister, Mr. Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mr. Ismail Sabri Yaqob, and Prime Minister of Vietnam, Mr. Pham Minh Thinh. I thank them for the time they've found to participate in this plenary session. As is tradition, the Eastern Economic Forum gives a platform to a discussion about projects and initiatives that are of paramount importance for the development of Russia's Far Eastern regions, for reinforcing cooperative and productive ties between Russia and the Asia-Pacific countries. Just as with our long-standing traditional partners and those countries that are only now starting to foster a dialogue with Russia across a wide spectrum of avenues and business projects. And of course, this meeting in Vladivostok is yet another good opportunity to have a look at the current state of affairs in the global economy, to have an exchange of opinions, to talk about the trends and major risks. Last year, the Eastern Economic Forum took place after a pause we had had to take due to the coronavirus pandemic. Back then, most experts concurred that the business environment was starting to recover across the world, and they thought that once the COVID restrictions were gone, it would very soon get back to normal. But the pandemic has been replaced by new challenges of a global nature carrying a threat to the whole world. I'm talking about the sanctions rush in the West and the West's blatant aggressive attempts to obtrude their modus vivendi on other countries, to take away their sovereignty, to submit them to their will. There's nothing new about that. That is the policy pursued by the collective West over the recent dozens of years. But these processes were precipitated by the US's slipping dominance in global economy and the global politics, as well as the obdurate reluctance, if not inability, of the Western elites to see and recognize the objective facts. As I said on multiple occasions, the whole system of international relations has seen irreversible tectonic shifts. We see a significant growth of the role of dynamic, promising countries and regions of the world, first and foremost the Asia-Pacific. The Asia-Pacific countries have turned into new centers of economic and technological development. They've become a magnet for human resources, capitals, and production capacities. Despite that, the Western countries are trying to maintain the old world order, which only benefited them. They want to make everyone live by the so-called rules that the West comes up with on its own. And it is also very often in breach of these very rules. And they are also trying to change these rules to suit their purposes based on the current circumstances. And when other countries refuse to follow this diktat and arbitrary rule, the Western elites, to put it bluntly, simply lose it. They take nearsighted, foolhardy decisions from the point of view of world affairs and world politics and the world economy. And these decisions run counter to the interests of nations and peoples, and in particular, the interests of the people of these very Western countries. And the level of industrial development Europe has attained, the quality of life, social and economic stability, all of that is being sort of burned to fuel the sanctions machine. It's been squandered at the behest of Washington in the name of the so-called Euro-Atlantic unity. But as a matter of fact, it's basically been offered as a sacrifice to maintain the US's dictatorial grip of the world affairs. Back in spring, many foreign corporations were racing to announce their pullout from Russia, thinking that it was our country that would stand to suffer the most out of that. But as we can see, Europe itself shutting down production facilities and jobs. And one of the key reasons is the severance of business ties with Russia. The competitiveness of European enterprises is going down because the EU authorities are basically denying them access to affordable raw materials, energy, and markets. And it comes as no coincidence if, as an outcome, the niche the European businesses used to occupy on the continent and globally is going to be snatched by their American patrons. Because when pursuing their interests, they never restrain themselves under any circumstances when they pursue a goal they have in mind. Moreover, in their attempt to stay the course of history, the Western countries have undermined the key pillars of the world economic system built over centuries. We have seen the loss of trust in the dollar and the euro and the pound as the currencies in which you can carry out transactions, hold deposits or assets. And that is why, step by step, we are moving away from the use of these unreliable, compromised currencies. And incidentally, even the US's allies are decreasing the assets denominated in dollars steadily. That is what the statistics tells us. The volume of transactions in dollars and the assets, everything has been decreased. Yesterday, Gazprom and its Chinese counterparts decided to move towards settlements in ruble and renminbi and the ratio 50 to 50 in the payment for gas. And these nearsighted actions by Western authorities has spurred on the global inflation, which is beating record highs in developed countries. Everyone knows that, but I'm going to reiterate that. In July, the US inflation stood at 8.5%. In Russia, it's around 14%. I'm going to get back to that. But unlike Western countries, we have a downward trend in inflation rates, whereas in Western countries, the trend is upwards. And by the end of the year, our inflation rate will have been around 12%, according to our experts. And in the first quarter next year, we will hit our target 5 or 6%, some say maybe even 4%. We'll see, but the trend is positive. And we see what happens in other countries. In Germany, it's 7.9, and Belgium, 9.9. In Lithuania, it's more than 20%. In the Netherlands, 14%. In Latvia, more than 20%. And in Estonia, it's 25%. And the trend is upwards. And this rising prices in the global markets can turn into true tragedy for the poorest countries that are suffering from shortages of food, energy, and other essential goods. Let me cite some statistics that underline how dire the situation is. The UN reported 135 million people in the world in 2019 to suffer from shortages of food. Right now, this number has doubled. It stands now at 345 million people. That's terrible. Moreover, the poorest countries are simply losing access to grain, to foodstuffs, because Western countries are buying out, and this can result in rising prices. Let me cite some statistics. You know how much discussion there's been about the need to secure exports from Ukraine, the exports of grain, to support the poorest countries. And we couldn't but respond to that. Despite all the difficulties around Ukraine, we did everything in our power to make sure that the Ukrainian grain exports could happen. And I met with the representatives of the African Union, with other leaders of African states. And I promised them that we would do everything in our power to secure their interests, to make sure that the Ukrainian grain could be exported. We did that together with Turkey. But what do we have as a result? Let me report to you. Excluding Turkey as the mediator country, almost all the grain exported from Ukraine is flowing not into the poorest countries, but into the European Union. Under the World Food Programme, under the aegis of the UN, that is meant for the needs of the poorest countries, only two ships have been sent, just two out of 87. It was used to export 60,000 tons of food out of 2 million, but that amounts to just 3% that has gone into the developing countries. In the previous countries, many European countries used to be colonial powers, and they continue to act as such. They are simply deceiving the developing countries. And I can say that if this approach continues, then the problem with the food is only going to exacerbate to our greatest regret, which can turn into a never-before-seen humanitarian catastrophe. We should probably think about limiting the destinations for grain exports, and I'm going to discuss that with Mr. Erdogan, President of Turkey, because it was he and I who came up with this plan. We need to help the poorest countries first and foremost. This is not what is happening right now. And I can tell you that this situation is the outcome of reckless actions pursued by the elites of the US, UK, and EU, who are laboring under political delusions. And they think that the welfare of their citizens, and even let alone people outside the so-called Golden Billion, well, the interests of these people are simply being relegated to the background. And inexorably, Western countries are going to end up in economic and social crisis, which will have unpredictable circumstances, outcomes for the rest of the world. Colleagues, Russia is steadily overcoming economic, financial, and technological aggression of the West. I cannot call it anything else. We've stabilized our currency market, our financial market. The inflation rate is going down. We have record lows in employment rates, less than 4%. And right now, the estimates and the forecasts of economic dynamics by entrepreneurs and experts, they are far more optimistic than back in spring. I would like to say that on the whole, the economic situation has been stabilized. It's true that we see problems in certain sectors, in certain regions, in certain companies, especially if those were reliant on supplies from Europe or were exporting their products to their markets. We will continue to work with the business to take swift action to launch efficient, targeted mechanisms for support. And I would like to ask the Governmental Commission on the Sustainability of the Russian Economy to pay particular attention to this issue. We are doing that on a daily basis, but despite these stabilization efforts, we are fully cognizant of the risks, and we are trying to keep that in mind. Russia is a sovereign nation. We will always protect our national interests, pursuing an independent policy. We highly value these very same qualities in our partners, who for many years have been demonstrating their reliability and responsibility in the course of trade, investment, and other types of cooperation. First and foremost, I refer to our colleagues from the Asia-Pacific. The overwhelming majority of the Asia-Pacific countries reject the destructive rationale behind the sanctions, because the centerpiece of our business-like relations is the principle of mutual benefit and cooperation. We bring together the potentials of our economy for the sake of our citizens. And this is our competitive edge. It is the foundation of our vibrant, long-term, sustainable development. And the growth rates here are ahead of the world average. You know that on a yearly basis, the Asian countries' GDP was growing at around 5%, the world rate was 3%, at the US it was 2%, and at the EU around 1%. And this trend is persisting. And inevitably, this is going to result in an increasing share of Asian countries' GDP and the world GDP. It's going to rise to 45% in 2027. It's important for us that the Russian Far East economy is also developing hand in hand with the economies of the Asia Pacific. And we need to improve the standard conditions and raise the welfare. We have to create high quality jobs and efficient production capacities. The Russian Far East has also, has already tested unique tax, administrative, and customs preferences. We are pursuing historic projects in such sectors as gas-based chemistry production, shipbuilding, biotech, and clean energy. And over the last 7 years, the production capacity in the Far East has grown by 25% or so, which is ahead of the countrywide average. So the Russian Far East is steadily growing at a faster pace than the rest of the country. We are going to stimulate further the advanced development of the Russian Far East. Making use of advanced measures of government support, we will create the best competitive environment for business. Here, we are going to continue to fine-tune the mechanism of advanced development territories for modern projects run together with other countries. We will put in place a favorable business environment to attract the cutting-edge technologies to Russia and also to foster production of goods with a high added value. And the recent developments have shown how important it is to have access to raw materials. Without raw materials, it's impossible to create any production capacities or create any cooperative value chains. Russia is probably the only country in the world that is self-sufficient from the point of view of its natural resources. The Russian Far East has an important role to play: oil, natural gas, coal, metals, timber, marine resources. All of that comes from the Far East. It's a major supplier to the domestic market and abroad. We also plan to efficiently use and develop our natural resources based on the most rigorous environmental standards, and we will achieve a high level of deep conversion of these resources in our country. We need to reinforce the sovereignty of our country, ensure our industrial security, and raise the incomes of our citizens and the development of regions. We've already protected our raw commodities from unfriendly actions. Only countries, companies working in the Russian jurisdiction can develop our natural resources. The Ministry of Natural Resources, working together with the Ministry of Trade and Industry, are working together with the business associations to determine our demands and strategic commodities, and this is the basis of an updated strategy for our mineral and commodity sources with a bigger time frame until 2050. We need to pay particular attention to geological survey and also processing of scarce goods such as titanium, manganese, lithium, and niobium that are used in metal production, medicine, chemical industry, microelectronics, aircraft building, and other sectors, in particular new technologies for the storage and transmission of energy. On a particular note, I would like to ask the government to have a look at the development of marine bioresources. We have a mechanism of investment quotas in place there. We need to achieve a well-balanced growth. We need to use our production capacities to the full and ensure a harmonious development of the regional infrastructure. I also would like to underline that the marine bioresources and the money we get from that, as a matter of priority, should be funneled into the development of rural infrastructure to support employment and raise incomes, and I would like to ask the government to take concrete steps to that end. Over the recent years, Russia has done a lot to develop transport infrastructure, railroads and automobile roads, seaports and pipelines. And these timely decisions have allowed our businesses, amid the current conditions, to swiftly rework the logistics, to redirect the cargo flows towards those countries that are still willing and who want to trade with our countries, who prefer civilized, predictable business relations. It's very telling that despite the attempted external pressure, the throughput of Russian seaports has barely decreased over the 7 months of this year. It's almost at the same level as it was a year ago, around 482 million tons. Last year it was 483 million tons, almost the same. And as far as the Far Eastern ports are concerned, they are going through a logistics boom. The transshipment volumes, the number of processed containers are so big that professionals have to work without breaks or holidays. Even though some want to isolate Russia, try as they might, it's impossible to achieve. And this is something we've been telling for quite some time now. Just look at the map. We use our natural competitive edge, and we will continue to boost our transport potential. We'll build a network of automobile and railroads. We will also build new access points to sea terminals. Their throughput capacity is going to rise as well. Our centerpiece is the eastern dimension of our infrastructure, and also the international north-south corridor and the ports of the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea. It will provide Russian companies with new opportunities. They will get access to the markets of Iran, India, the Middle East, and Africa, and it'll facilitate supplies from these countries in return. And by 2030, the overall cargo carriage volume through these main lines can rise by 60%. These are realistic forecasts, and this will happen. To achieve that, the government has come up with concrete roadmaps. There are three avenues. I've already named them. It will allow us to work systemically. We'll integrate the routes, fine-tune the timing and the throughput capacity, resolve the bottlenecks, modernize border checkpoints and the related infrastructure. Together with these plans on transport corridors, it's important to modernize the rolling stock and the traction vehicles. On the Russian railroads, we need to provide our shipyards with the high-quality orders. They have to build tankers, bulk carriers, container ships, in particular to continue to develop the Northern Sea Route, which is a powerful transport route of national and global significance. I'll underscore that it's navigable year-round. We have modern icebreakers, and we design them, we build them, and they make this possible. This year, we have seen the first container ship run between Murmansk and Kamchatka along the Northern Sea Route. It is yet another testimony of the reliability and the safety of this ship escort pattern. And it's not just about joining these two destinations together. We need to make sure that in each port along the route, it's possible to get technical maintenance, to process goods. The schedule should be regular and predictable. And in that case, all the points along the route and the Northern Sea Route will stand to benefit from this logistics corridor. And this is something we have to strive for. The government has adopted the plan for the development of the Northern Sea Route until 2035. We plan to allocate 8 trillion rubles from different sources to implement this plan. The throughput capacity and the cargo volume is projected to rise from 35 million right now to 220 million tons per year. And of course, we need to have supplies coming from the Far East and backwards, and that is why we need a reasonable competitive rate. And I would like to ask the government to work this through. On a particular note, aviation is of the utmost importance for the Russian Far East. And it's not just about flights from the European part of Russia. We also need to achieve connectivity in the Russian Far East between as many settlements and regions in the Russian Far East as possible. And that is why we've set up a unified Russian Far East air company. It services almost 390 destinations and some tickets get government subsidies. In the next 3 years, the volume should rise and the destinations should also become more numerous. And they are in high demand. And because of that, we need to increase the aircraft fleet. We need to equip it with modern aircraft, in particular small aircraft. The decision has already been made, and I would like the government to strictly stick to it. And of course, on a systemic basis, the Russian airlines have to be re-equipped and modernized. Aeroflot has already come up with the biggest order portfolio to the tune of around 500 long-haul aircraft produced in Russia. And incidentally, the agreement between the Unified Aircraft Corporation and Aeroflot has been signed in the sidelines of the Eastern Economic Forum to the tune of around 1 trillion, if my memory serves me correctly. This is a very strong incentive for the plans and for the design bureaus and for related sectors. In particular, electronics. We need to help develop medical aircraft to make sure that medical aid is accessible to those who live in the remote areas. And starting from next year, we will double federal funds allocated for these purposes. The number of flights is going to rise, medical aid is going to be provided with a greater level of quality and faster. Distinguished friends, all the decisions in economy and the social sphere, all these mechanisms we implement in the Russian Far East pursue one and the same goal. We need to make this region attractive to live, to study, to work, for people to build new families here, to have more children, and that is why we need to also build a very comfortable environment for living here, and we need to develop cities and towns, and that is why at the last year's forum, I came up with the task to develop master plans for the biggest Russian Far Eastern cities, administrative centers with the population of more than 50,000 people, and also Tinder and Severobaikals, the key points on the Baikal-Amur mainline. And we need to pursue a comprehensive approach. We need to integrate the modernization of infrastructure, social sphere, building public spaces, and we also have to link that to economic projects, industrial projects based on well-calculated business models. All cities have got down to develop strategic plans. At the same time, 17 cities and agglomerations are engaged in an active development of a master plan. Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky is one such example. The day before yesterday, we talked about that with colleagues on the ground, and I would like to ask the government to provide their utmost assistance to these projects, to these master plans, to make sure they happen. We need to use such instruments as the Russian Far Eastern Concession, infrastructure budget loans and infrastructure bonds. We also need to set the target caps for the Russian Far East. And these funds should be used to develop cities, make them more comfortable. We need to modernize the infrastructure, in particular the utilities, facilities and communications. I would like to add that the recent St. Petersburg Economic Forum, I instructed the government to allocate an additional 10 billion rubles on a yearly basis on urban development. And I think it is only going to be right if half of these funds, namely 5 billion rubles on a yearly basis, is funneled into the development of the Russian far-eastern settlements with a population of up to 250,000 people. And of course, we need to allocate additional resources for the modernization of far-eastern countries. And I'd like that to happen as soon as possible, and we need to determine the target caps for the next 3 years as part of the federal budget. We also need to boost the construction of housing in the Russian Far East. We need to use cutting-edge, clean, efficient technologies. This year, we've launched the Far Eastern Neighborhoods Program. The construction companies will be able to take advantage of advanced development territories. They will have access to tax and infrastructure-related preferences. This will bring down the cost and price of housing. It'll make housing more accessible to our citizens. This mechanism will give us an additional 2.5 million square meters of housing by 2030. And I would like to ask the regional authorities and the Ministry for the Development of the Russian Far East to hold first tenders, choose the construction contractors by the end of the year, and also start designing and building new houses. The Russian Far East citizens also have access to preferential mortgages, and 48,000 families have already bought it with a mortgage of 2% year rate. And this year, we've also expanded this program. Doctors and teachers, regardless of their age, have access to this program. This program is scheduled to run until 2024, but I think since it's in such high demand, it can be extended until 2030. I think this would be the right thing to do. On a particular note, we need to think about young professionals who come to the Russian Far East, or those who graduate from universities here, who find a job here, or are searching for the place of their own to live in. They will have 10,000 flats for rent. The rent rates will be lower than the market average, thanks to the subsidies from the regional and federal authorities. The government has already made the arrangements, and we need to start without delay to build these flats. And of course, it has to be linked to the master plans for the development of the Russian Far Eastern cities. All the requisite infrastructure needs to be there. So this housing should be in demand. It should be comfortable. And I would also like to say that just as other Russian regions, the Russian Far East is running against a shortage of human resources. And we need to accelerate the training of new human resources. Until 2030, the Russian Far Eastern colleges will see the opening of more than 900 workshops. And until 2025, we will launch 29 production and education clusters, and companies will get special compensation if they employ young people. A particular avenue we pursue is high-quality tertiary education in the Russian Far East. We need highly qualified teachers and professors, material and technological base for tertiary education grants for science and other technological projects. There are network programs between the Russian Far Eastern universities and other leading universities, such as the St. Petersburg State Marine Technical University, the Moscow Aviation Institute, and others. And we will certainly support this avenue. Finally, to train those who will work in arts and culture in 2025, we will open branches of the Russian University of Theatre Arts, Old Russian State Institute of Cinematography, and the Boris Shukin Theatre Institute, and the Russian Far East, and like to government, to ask the government to provide their assistance. And of course, it's important that the Russian Far Eastern regions come up with initiatives to develop professional careers with the help of the Strategic Initiatives Agency and Sakhalin. We are launching a pilot project, Let's Make Money Together. Those who participate will get additional training and professional guidance. They will receive assistance in starting their own business and will think about replicating this experience henceforth. And I would also like to say that we need to think about preparing a new generation of top managers. This program is called Muravyova Morskaya. It combines internships and education programs. This program has already been launched, and I would like to ask the heads of all Russian regions of the Far Eastern Federal District to take active part in it. Distinguished colleagues, I'd like to say once again that the global economy and the global international relations systems is undergoing profound shifts, but I'm confident that cooperation, joining our potentials together, and the principle of mutual benefit, these are the principles we stick to together with our partners, and I am confident that these principles will prevail. Efficient use of our strong suits and competitive edges in the Asia-Pacific, as well as a constructive partnership, all of that will provide us and our nations with enormous new opportunities. We are willing to work together in the name of a successful future, and we're grateful to our partners for participating in our work today in this Eastern Economic Forum. Thank you for your attention.